On the line with us from Cape Town, South Africa, is Salima Valiani, who has done a great amount of research regarding the mining industry, which is a topic that we've been covering for the past few weeks. Hello, Salima.
Hi there.
Could you give us a sense of how big the general mining industry is throughout the world?
I'm looking at photos on top of my desk here, which are of an international mining network, and these are indigenous peoples groups and NGOs from Asia, Africa, and South America that are focusing on mining. It's about five countries in Asia in this network. There's a British organization, there are Canadian groups, Americans, Australians, and then about three organizations in Africa, and then another four or five from Latin America. So all of these people's organizations are dealing with mining issues. And the northern groups that I mentioned, Australia, Britain, Canada, and the U.S. also, they are dealing with the companies more directly in their home countries. So, I mean, this is a huge industry. It's providing the raw materials that we have been using for a good 100 years. And it's stretching itself into more and more areas that were formerly used for other purposes, you know, including agriculture, wildlife preservation. So yes, this is a huge expanse, and the Canadian capitalists for a change are quite prominent.
And what role do Canadian transnationals play in the worldwide industry?
Well, there's a few very large Canadian corporations, Alcan, as you mentioned, Inco, which is a nickel company. And then there are many Canadian companies which do exploration and engineering. So they're more middle-sized companies. And they are very organized in Canada. So they lobby the Canadian government. And so we have to also remember the Canadian government's role. They basically further the interests of these different companies, both inside Canada and in the key mineral-rich countries around the world.
And how does the Canadian government actually further the interests of these corporations?
I'll give you an example of a few of the different ways in which the government pursues the interests of these companies. You have at the international level, of course, all kinds of discussions of sustainable development. The UN, for example, had a major summit a few years ago. So the Canadian government is there to assure that in all international treaties, the mining companies' rights are preserved. And this is come into question by human rights groups, indigenous groups, people like the groups I was mentioning earlier. So those groups are also trying at the international level to question the industry, and they are constantly coming up against the Canadian government, which pushes for very tight language to protect these companies. What I mean by protect is to avoid them having to deal with human rights questions and community consultation before they build their mines and while they are in countries. So that's the international sort of political layer. You also have within particular countries where Canadian companies are very large, for example, Indonesia, you have the Canadian High Commission or the Canadian consulates that constantly deal with other companies that are based, other mining companies that are based in that country, as well as the governments of those countries. So you'll have the ambassador of Canada in Indonesia in constant contact with high-level officials in Indonesia. These sessions become more intense when problems come up, for example, where communities are dying from pollution caused by the mine, or communities are having trouble getting land covered by the mining companies in terms of money or relocations. So there's that role that the Canadian government plays. And then within Canada, you have the Minister of Minerals and Resources that lobbies within the government for assistance to the mining companies. This can be subsidies, this can be tax breaks, the full gamut. Trade interests, for example, when the Canadian government goes to the WTO, there might be specific clauses that the companies want in international trade agreements. So you'll have the Minister of Minerals and Resources voicing those needs within Canada as well.
Presumably, the reason that the Canadian government would support these multinationals is rooted in economic reasons. What's the sort of economic base to a lot of the Canadian government's decisions to back this industry in particular within the country and also support its transnationals to pursue their activities without sort of regulations outside of the country?
I'd say there are economic reasons and historical reasons, you know, more basically. We have these large Canadian companies that have existed for some time. A lot of them started right inside Canada, Alcan, Inco. So they are established in our culture, you see, as providing a useful resource. Never mind all the questions that have come up in terms of, you know, how metals are processed, what they go on to build, cars, you know, armaments, many things that are not necessarily productive, but they have become culturally accepted as productive. So you have a cultural belief, you know, on the part of our governments and, I mean, people in general, that these companies are fulfilling an important role in the world economy. So that then perpetuates itself. The other aspect is that these companies have been digging out the minerals and processing them and transporting them around the world for so long at a certain set of prices that have become familiar and acceptable. And so that's the more economic reason, if you like, that, you know, we have to support these companies that are so well trained in this field.
I wanted to sort of move into the specifics of the industry. You mentioned at the beginning that, you know, there's sort of this divide between the North and the South in terms of how mining, the entire mining cycle gets played out. A lot of the corporations such as Alcan and Inco are based in Canada, but a lot of the actual extraction happens in other parts of the world on Indigenous land, oftentimes in the global South. Could you elaborate on this for us? How is the split up of the different types of the industry occurring throughout the world?
We have to remember that the global South is, of course, 75% of the world. So it's not surprising that many or most of the mineral sources are in the South. And that has always been the case. When Alcan started out, for example, in the early 20th century, it was mining bauxite in Jamaica and Guyana. Inco, on the other hand, was getting nickel and copper from Sudbury, and then it expanded more internationally. So the divide is not so much how we think of it in terms of North-South politics. It's a physical reality that these companies have to be extracting from all over, because most of, including the South, because most of the sources are in the South. I would say the difference in terms of how they behave, and we can also note this within Canada or within the U.S., is with the populations that are living on the lands which are needed by the companies to mine. Unfortunately, it seems that as soon as you have an Indigenous group or a non-white population, the set of rules changes. So the way that Alcan deals with Native people in Quebec is different from how they'll treat people living in the area that's relevant to their smelting operation in Kitimat, BC. Similarly, you have a complete set, different set of rules that operate for Inco in Indonesia versus parts of Ontario now. But even where you had mainly white populations in Ontario affected by Inco mines, you get a great amount of abuse of human rights. So people in Ontario, for example, are dealing with the backlog of closed mines of Inco are getting very, very short-shifted with their concerns regarding cleaning the water and cleaning the soil that has been polluted by tailings. So there are those struggles as well. But I would say it is safe to generalize that the rules change when these companies operate in the South.